Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Hi, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work better, filled with fascination about work, culture and happiness. If you're thinking, how can I bring the pleasure back to my work? That's our mission every week, to try and find some evidence and science of how to do that. You can sign up for our mailing list by going to the website eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. And while you're there, you can find episodes with Seth Godin, Dan Pink, Daniel Coyle, Sophie Scott, Adam Grant and Angela Duckworth, a whole load of people. This week, there's two episodes on one profession, and I've focused on it because I think we can learn lessons from this profession about our own jobs. Last week's episode was inside hospitals. This week, two episodes about the police. Now, later this week, I'll be dropping a second episode, which is talking about innovation under pressure, chatting to Stephen Colgan, and he's a fascinating character. He's now a TV comedy writer. He spent a career in the police in the crime prevention unit, and it's fascinating. One of the things that he discovered was when trying to reduce the noise from nightclubs, he found that people couldn't make noise when they were eating sweets. So his crime prevention there was giving lollipops to people as they left nightclubs. That is a fascinating discussion. If you want to see how under pressure people can think of clever solutions, you'll love that episode. Today, I'm thrilled to have Andy Rhodes, who's the Chief Constable of the Lancashire Constabulary. And so Lancashire Constabulary, up in the northwest of the UK. Andy's had 24 years policing experience in a whole range of different areas, covering investigations, firearms, counter-terrorism. But now he's the national lead for well-being and engagement in the police. And I think it's this discussion there that really shows the challenge and how they're rising to it. I think really critically, there's a danger that in any profession, stress permeates our decision-making. And none more so than in the police. If someone is under stress and making quick judgments and assessments, clearly there can be a pitfall of that. Andy really talks about how he creates a climate of safety, how he tries to ensure that these high levels of accountability, but also strong levels of trust. Really brilliant discussion. Here's Andy. So Andy, you and I had this amazing chat, right, where you sort of giving me an insight into something that through my pampered office prism of vision, I hadn't seen. And it was this idea that the stress that in what you call blue light professions is having a massive impact on the ability to do the job. Do you want to just give us a step back and talk about maybe what's changed or why that's so important?
Well, I think it's one of these things that's coming to the forefront now because in general society, people are more confident to talk about things like mental health. So the stigma's reducing. And in our organisation, there's a very strong culture, be strong culture, where, you know, we don't talk about this sort of thing. So
this is specifically in the police?
This is specifically, I think it relates to other organisations. I mean, in general life, people don't always feel comfortable talking about the mental health. So, you know, if they've got a physical illness, people talk about it. But if they've got a mental health issue, even stress and anxiety, depression, that type of thing, they're more reluctant to talk about it. And it's certainly been the case in the police that you really, in the culture I've come through, you just don't talk about this sort of stuff and you get on with it. over the last few years, it's really started to come to the surface because there's a lot more conversations going on in general society about mental health. And what you find when you started, when we started looking at this work into policing and other blue light services, like, you know, your fire, your ambulance, your A&E departments, these are what we call high emotional labour jobs. They are jobs where you're exposed to a lot of traumatic experiences over and over again. And if you are not talking about them, you're not processing them, and they can build up over time and have really detrimental effects to, not, you know, mainly to you and your own health, but lots of other things in your life and actually the organisation.
So do you, by that, do you mean, I'm trying to empathise with what a job looks like, but you're called out on call, you're asked to try and assess the situation and to actually bring empathy to that situation. Yeah. So what's gone on? And that constant sense of injecting yourself into different scenarios, yes, is emotionally sapping.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And I think, so when I first joined the job, I came from a background where I'd never experienced some of the things that I started to see,
yeah,
when I joined the police. It's like a whole world.
What sort of thing?
Well, you know, seeing the difficult circumstances some people live in, seeing a domestic violence victim that's
been assaulted. Were you out and about doing police work?
Yeah, when you first join, yeah, everybody starts, everybody who's a chief constable like me starts out operationally, right, as a PC.
Do you? What, yeah, to see the reality of the
everybody
job?
Everybody comes from the shop floor up.
Right, and so you're
policing. You're there suddenly, are new routes in now, the way you don't do that, right, but it, predominantly we still all start at the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're out and about,
yeah,
and you're seeing all that.
Yeah, and it becomes, what happens is, you see, you're working with other people who are just going, well, this is what we do. And so you start to normalise it.
Right.
And because you normalise it, your levels of what shocks you start to raise and raise and raise.
How quickly does that change?
Very, very quickly.
Does it?
Yeah, very quickly. Within the first couple of years of attending incidents, you know, you've got police officers dealing with, even more so now, you know, they're dealing regularly with suicides. They're dealing with road traffic collisions. They're dealing with serious woundings. They're dealing with indecent imagery that they've got to view and grade. These are experiences that generally most people don't have. And I think most police officers, police staff, you know, your paramedics, they take a real pride actually in the ability to be able to do that work and remain compassionate. So the big argument I have with this is that if you don't invest in what I'm trying to do, you're unable to retain your empathy and compassion. You'll either burn out because you're too empathetic, or you'll become dispassionate. You'll end up being very cold. And when you call, God forbid any of us should have to have that knock on the door, you want somebody to have empathy. It's the golden factor. You want empathy if you're getting a Starbucks, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They talk about the empathy era, don't they?
Yeah.
So what we talk about is, you know, trust, confidence is everything in policing, because we only police with consent in this country. That's the idea. That
what does
actually,
that even mean? What's that
mean? What it means is that there's a legitimacy to the fact that we have operational independence in this country from politics. Some people might argue with that, to how far down that route sometimes policing goes. But ultimately, people have got to trust the police in order to call them when they need help,
yeah,
rely on them to exercise the powers correctly. And there's lots of times where, you know, there's lots of examples where this doesn't go very well. But fundamentally, British policing is founded on that. So, you know, one of the things that I think I try to talk about a lot around this particular issue is that, you know, you might very rarely call the police. But when you do, your expectations are very, very high of not just the competency, but the way that you're treated. The way you're treated is as if not more important than actually the competency of the person doing what they're doing.
But someone needs to look like they care.
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than your crime is necessarily processed, precisely.
Yeah. So what's happened in policing is there's been some really good, interesting research done around an issue called organisational justice. Organisational justice is that how your organisation treats you whether it's really well or really badly, will transfer onto how you treat your customer or the public in our case. If my people working in my organisation don't think they're treated fairly, that we care about them, that will have a knock-on effect into how they behave operationally. And I think that's a powerful argument for some of the things we're trying to do around bringing a different culture into.
So you're saying there's evidence that if you treat your police employees well,
yeah,
they will treat the people they're dealing with well.
I'll give you an example of this one, Bruce. Right, my wife, when she was younger, used to work for a retail clothing company. Yeah. It was a part-time job.
Yeah.
And the people who ran it weren't very nice to the staff. The staff were stealing things off them just because they didn't like the bosses.
Yeah.
And this all goes fundamentally back to, this isn't new stuff actually. Some people in leadership positions have understood this for donkey's years. When I first started on the Wellbeing Agenda, there was a friend of mine who's in the military. He said, you've got to read a book called From Defeat to Victory by Lord Slim, the story of the Burma campaign. And I thought, well, what's that got to do with wellbeing? Surely it's about how to storm a machine gun nest. But I make a comparison between the Burma campaign and, I won't name the company, but a company that my wife's daughter worked for, a big retail outlet, in 2017 on Black Friday. So what happened in 1943 is we were losing the war in Burma against the Japanese, and everybody thought that the army had lost the bottle. Lord Slim was sent out there thinking, come on, get the oomph back in. He worked out there was more people dying from dysentery, malaria, poor healthcare than there was from Japanese bullets.
Right.
Four times as many.
Yeah.
And he formed the opinion that there's three things keep people moving forward. Adrenaline, even if when you're at work.
I'm looking forward to how this works for Black Friday.
Well, I've got this. Right. You will have, when you've got a real deadline to hit, sometimes, if you're in a team environment, it's a bit of a buzz, isn't it? You've got a bit of adrenaline getting something. It applies to any walk of life.
Yeah.
In my walk of life, it's right, there's a burglar, you know, running through the gardens. We're all off. We're forgetting about whether we're going to jump in somebody's greenhouse or there's going to be a pit bull behind the gate. We're off. The second thing is camaraderie. So Bruce is going, I'm going to go. Anyway, the third thing, though, and it's what they'd lost, was the realistic expectation that if you fell, your organisation would be there for you, pick you up and look after you.
Okay.
Right, now, fast forward to the retail company.
I'm all ears.
It's Black Friday.
I'm all ears.
You've got a load of kids studying at university, and they are wired up in this shop. This is a big, big, busy clothing retail shop on a high street. Everybody's on adrenaline. They've camaraderie because, you know, we're all working together, going out for drink afterwards, and we're all a big team, and it's just we're working our socks off. She asks her manager when her grandma is ill, who's got dementia, and her mum says, you might need to get home quick because she might not be here very much longer. She asks for 2 hours off early to go early, and they say, no, you can't go. They've lost her. They've lost discretionary effort.
Right.
So everybody...
What, because you don't think... Back to your thing. You don't think they've got your back.
Yeah, because what they're doing is they're putting a lot of discretionary effort in. All that running around and working longer hours. They're working a lot longer hours than they're getting paid for. Right. My people are putting themselves in positions of all sorts of things. You can't force them to do it.
Right.
I can't force a police officer to carry a gun. I can't force a member of police staff to view indecent images all day. It's a voluntary, discretionary thing. Stopping a car with three people on down a country lane, you know what I mean, on your own.
Remind me of those things. So it was adrenaline.
Camaraderie.
And
a realistic expectation that actually your organisation gives a toss about you.
So bring it to the police. Is this backing them when there's a question about their integrity?
The thing is, when you then get into it, and all the research that we've done with Dr. Ian Hesketh and everything, discretionary effort's the thing. All businesses run, to some degree or another, on discretionary effort. Back to Starbucks. It's discretionary about whether when you get your flat white, it's done with a smile and how are you, Bruce?
Yeah, I can see that.
We don't have to do it. In my job, discretionary effort, you can't even cost it.
Right.
Because it's something that I think sometimes we take for granted. When you get into how do you protect discretionary effort, and then you get into staff engagement with your people, real staff engagement, not an annual survey, but multiple channels of staff engagement to get feedback. That tells you things that you probably assumed or didn't even know. And the things that it tells you that are important to people are fairness. how things are done around here is fair. I don't want to be treated unfairly. That might be a promotion process. It might be, well, hold on a minute, there aren't enough people on my shift. I haven't got the right kit. You know, I've got a team leader who doesn't really seem to be interested in me. I've got a complaint and the organisation all of a sudden is like focusing it all on me rather than actually an organisation failing. What people get into then is, and this is the issue with people when you start looking at wellbeing, it all looks like everything. So lots of different factors. So when you look at, when you ask people what drives their discretionary effort, you can start prioritising the things that you spend your time.
Right. And what would they be? So, firstly, I'm very interested in the conflict, the innate conflict that must run through all of that, where simultaneously you've got multiple parties, haven't you? Simultaneously, yeah. Member of the public says the police have, in some way, encroached in their liberties. Yeah, yeah. You need to demonstrate that you've taken that seriously, yes. while also creating a trusting environment that the police are going to be given a fair hearing and given the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, how do you even start there?
Well, and of course, this is one of the issues we were discussing with the Police Foundation last night. Because people perceive or believe that they're not going to be treated fairly in that situation, they become very defensive. And the first thing they don't do, which is what most organisations want to do if they've made a mistake, is apologise and say, really sorry that your flat white was cold. I'll make you another one. So what happens in organisations where there's low trust is people don't feel confident to just say, I made a mistake. Or we don't feel confident enough to say, oh, really sorry about that. What can we do to learn? Because most members of the public actually just want the job to be done right, don't they? There's many aspects to it, but that you've picked up on a very important one there is how do we deal with that conflict where there's a very high expectation? The trust levels in the police in this country are very, very high.
Mm.
And they've remained high despite some very high profile errors that we've made. Because we are in a very high risk business, quite frankly. And mistakes are made. And sometimes we have people working for us who do bad things that they shouldn't do, like any organisation. But because we are a monopoly business, you can't choose who your police service is. Because we have enormous authority, we can deprive people of the liberty and do all sorts of things. It's really, really important that we get that right about fairness. The point, I think, that comes out of the wellbeing agenda is what I think is a very good route to take to get a lot of these discussions going in an organisation, because they're not talked about a lot. And so if we look at, right, OK, well, people don't feel they've been treated fairly because a complaint's been made and how we've dealt with it. Well, what's the organisational impact of that on behaviours? Do people stop doing a certain type of work? Do they avoid going to certain types of jobs? Do they basically lawyer up and stop talking? And do we become very adversarial? rather than deal with it proportionately, recover the service, and then learn from it and move on. So we know that we're in a very, very highly regulated type of work, necessarily so. But that high regulation creates sometimes a real concern along the workforce about whether or not they're going to be treated proportionately, if they've made a genuine mistake or they've got a vexatious complainer. I think I look at all those things through what's the emotional impact and psychological impact on the work, on the people who work here.
Now, in terms of the psychological impact, the one thing that you were telling me about, that job that's so emotionally wearing, unchecked, you've observed that it can affect the judgment of the people concerned.
Yeah. What you have with exposure to, and this is well documented, sort of really, really complex, need, difficult environments, which is majority of what we work in, and exposure to trauma, so regular exposure to trauma, is that your brain, and we're doing a lot of work with this, Dr. Jess Miller's doing a load of work on this, supported by the Police Dependence Trust, to look at the neuroscience of how we process trauma. And what the brain does is it ceases to be able to cope with processing your trauma, because you're having so much of it.
What, every day you're scraping someone off the road, you go into...
And this is very similar to a child that's brought up in a household where there's a lot of traumatic incidents, right? So the brain can only process trauma and make sense of it and file it away at a certain rate. And it's like having, she describes it like having a desktop on your computer with a load of files open, documents open.
Okay.
And they're not getting made sense of and put away. What can happen is certain types of pejorative attitudes and beliefs can start to be created because you haven't had time to process them. So if you look at how other professions deal with this, and I think I mentioned this to you, my wife's a psychotherapist, a counsellor, she has to have supervision. And the reason she has supervision is to talk through how she's feeling about her clients.
Right.
Because if she starts having a certain view about them, blaming them, judging them, getting, which you will, because you're dealing with very difficult, complex cases, that will affect her ability to have empathy and be congruent with them.
So what you're basically saying is, if by 10 years tenure as a therapist, you start developing a bit of pattern recognition and you start profiling people.
Yes.
So that could be in terms of the police, it could be a racial profiling or an age profiling. That estate.
It could be everybody who's got a drug problem is a thief.
Right.
You know.
And but this must be hard because pattern recognition must help the police.
Useful. Well, you see, this is obviously the dichotomy. There is the what they call the copper's nose, which is that just doesn't look right. Intuition.
Yeah.
Now, intuition can be born out of some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's thousands and thousands of experiences. And that I go to that front door, knock on it, and say, I've heard there's a report, there's a disturbance going here, and somebody says, no, there's nothing going on here, mate. Everything's fine. What we don't want is police officers going, all right, thanks very much.
Yeah.
Are you with me? We want them to be curious, tenacious, and dogged. And we want them to be suspicious. So the other thing you've got at play here, Bruce, is we actually train people to be suspicious. I'm suspicious. When I walk out there, say, if I walked out there with you, I'd be looking for different things than you would.
Right.
I'm hypervigilant. And I've not been on the front line as long as some people. And hypervigilance is a well-documented phenomenon within military.
Yeah, military. You hear about it all the time, don't you?
Hypervigilance.
People checking exits.
I'm constantly looking around the place to see who might be up to something they shouldn't be up to. And I am profiling people, unfortunately, based on my previous experiences.
Yeah.
That's even more reason. Just the fact that I'm aware of that is helpful.
Right.
If I'm not aware of it and I'm doing that, I'm not guarding against going up to somebody saying, look, the reason I want to search you is because of this.
Right.
Are you with me? And I'm not communicating.
So then tell me this. So your job then is to prevent that being a blight on certain communities, victimisation of certain communities. So how do you start reconciling those two things?
Well, that's one really sharp operational case for it.
Yeah.
What we don't want is decision-making bias based on a human being who has been exposed to trauma and not been supported to process it.
Yeah.
There are lots of other aspects. Your relationships, we talked about that before we started, outside of work. You don't want people to start thinking, only people in my organisation see the world the way that I do.
Yeah.
You don't want the stress of it. Because what happens is that people's cups are quite full with this unprocessed trauma. So it goes up, it doesn't come down to quite the same level. It goes up, it stays a little bit higher. And years and years and years of this, you can end up at 80%. And therefore, something that looks quite innocuous can tip people over. And of course, what we want to get to look at, and this is the same with trauma-informed work with vulnerable people, is that don't always focus on what's happening at the moment, understand what's happened before.
Right.
And so when I... What I'm trying to encourage is a compassionate workplace where we're slightly less judgmental of each other when things, you know, people's behaviours start to look odd or they're working in a certain way and think, well, maybe that's because of A, B and C. Maybe that's because we aren't supporting people enough to process what sort of experience they're having. So I'm looking at it as a very big positive, this, because I think de facto more people are talking about the mental health. Certainly the people that we're recruiting these days are more confident talking about the mental health, and they have higher expectations of their organisation that, you know, this is a stressful job, folks. What are you doing to support me? Are you with me? What are you doing to help me develop my own resilience?
Okay.
What's the culture like here? What's my line manager's approachability like? So I'll give you an example. Five Live came out and did some filming on this particular topic for their Sunday morning show. And they went out in Blackburn with a load of my officers. And they interviewed and actually put on the Twitter feed one of my female officers. who said, yeah, I've had a mental health issue. She said, when the murders of the two officers in GMP happened, Fiona and Nicola, it really affected me. And I just didn't feel right coming to work. Something wasn't right. I've got 11 years in. I've been to all sorts of stuff. It was just across the border. I'm a female officer. I just couldn't understand why I didn't feel right, but I definitely didn't feel like I was as resilient as I normally am. She said, I went to my sergeant, Stu, who said, no problem. Come off the front line into some CBT counselling. She said, I had CBT counselling very quickly, really good quality, I'm back at work.
Cognitive behavioural therapy.
Right. Now, my point is, if she'd have said, I came to work and my back was killing me.
Right.
You know, and she'd gone, oh, it's great, because they got me into some physio.
Right.
And
I was back. No one would have blinked.
No one would have blinked. You know, because we're all okay, aren't we, with physio?
Right.
But we're not okay with something that's going wrong in our head. So she went in for a checkup from the neck up, as I like to call it.
Yeah.
And she's back out. So that's what I need to get to everywhere.
Right.
I need my people self-aware enough to spot when they've got a problem. I need them feeling confident they can go, particularly to the line manager, and go, will you listen to me? And I need that line manager to be well informed about where the choices are for that individual. That is the nirvana of sorting out a lot of the issues that we've got around people who are exposed to this type of work.
And do you think it produces measurably better policing?
Well, I think...
Or is that not the objective?
I think, well, look at it on a hard cost issue. If that hadn't have happened and she'd gone off sick and into crisis, escalated into crisis, that's tens, hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of public money and one resource less, keeping us all safe. So on a head and heart, I always say to people, the head issue with this is pounds and pence and deployable resource, keeping people safe. The heart bit is, back to Lord Slim.
Yeah.
Morally, yeah, if you've got people out there doing this type of work, or actually in any organisation, you know, putting themselves out there for you, you know, it's tough, isn't it? You know, earning a living.
Do you feel under scrutiny? Because I'm just, as you're telling me that story now, I'm trying to think, you know, all public services are scrutinised by the press.
Yeah.
Extremely. And I can imagine a scenario where someone might look at the mental health budget of the police force and from an uncharitable perspective, say something horrible in the press about it's like trendy, namby-pamby that we never used to do it. Do you feel under scrutiny for those things?
I think less so, because I think even in some of the media channels that do like to have a go at the police, you know, because we're there to be able to go at, and we tend to be in the clanger-dropping business, there's always something going wrong. Even there, I think mental health and the stigma around it, there's been so much progress made that I think people accept. I'll tell you what I find really interesting. Five Live said to me, I've never had as much positive feedback about an issue to do with policing. Because what people are getting insight into is not just the cops and robbers bit of policing, but actually the emotional experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of people think, it's a tough job, this.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not paid hundreds of thousands. Nobody joins the police to get rich.
Yeah.
So they're a decent bunch doing the best. And actually, I think we should be supporting them. So generally speaking, no, I think most... I find the opposite, actually. I find politically this is a very, very hot topic to engage on, that politically people are very interested and supportive in. It's not about whinging that we haven't got enough resource. It's about saying, what are we doing in terms of our duty of care? And actually, there's a real public value to getting this right, which means when you get a knock on your door, God forbid you do, you've got the compassion that you need, because that human who comes to your door...
isn't damaged by 20 years of trauma.
Right, yeah. And I'll tell you now, we have got some phenomenal people who managed to manage this. Hitherto, any of this work going on, family liaison officers, you'll speak to people I've had family liaison officers, particularly from road traffic collisions, who they're still in touch with years and years after they've had a bereavement. And, you know, I talk to a lot of family liaison officer groups, and I talk about the different applications of empathy, because they've got to have a bit of self-empathy as well. You don't want to jump in too far with your empathy, because you can get emotional burnout.
Right.
But you don't want to be too objective and sterile. You want compassionate empathy, which is the ability to hold both types of empathy with a victim of crime or somebody who's, you know, in a difficult situation.
Tell me this. you must run these things. Do people enjoy being police? Just because, like, you know, all the time that I put myself in these shoes, I think, wow, I can imagine the original appeal of it, but it feels exhausting imagining it.
Well, I think that, people, we have a very low turnover rate.
Do you? Okay.
4% turnover rate in policing. Public sector's normally 10 or 11.
Yeah.
Private sector's 16. There are pockets of higher turnover, like contact centres, but a lot of that turnover is because people join as police staff and then they're getting in as police officers. People might take this the wrong way. I think there's a real aspect of policing that's part of a caring profession. More so now, because the type of work that our people do, you know, 80% of what we do in policing now is supporting people who've got mental health issues, missing from homes, child sexual exploitation, domestic abuse.
That's
80%? 80%. That's well documented. You can look at, I take 1.2, 1.3 million calls in Lancashire a year, 999s and 101s. And when you break all that down, the vast majority are complex need type issues. And it's right that the police get called to those when people are in crisis. But for a big generation like my generation of police, that I wasn't doing as much of that when I joined. I was chasing a lot of burglars about, going to pub fights, lots of blue lights, all that sort of stuff. And that is exciting. It's not as... It's, when you ask police officers and police staff what you find stressful, it's never the running around with a blue light on to a pub fight. They actually find that quite cathartic.
Okay.
It is the entrenched complex need, difficult stuff that's heartbreaking. Day in, day out, seeing intergenerational vulnerability perpetuating through a cycle of a family unit or something. Right. It's, you know, it's seeing people struggling, you know, in very difficult circumstances and being exploited.
Is it sort of softer skills? Would you say it's...
Well, I think, you know, certainly we are... You know, we're with society, we're changing. The type of people who join the policing are changing. You know, and they are coming into it knowing the type of environment they're coming into.
Yeah.
You know, so you couldn't get an application in my force to join as a regular police officer unless you'd had 2 years' experience working with people with complex needs.
Oh, really? What, so people have to sign up and do that as proof of interest?
And it's a miss... It's
where complex needs is what?
So, you know, you have done volunteering or you've worked in social care. Samaritans. You might have been a paramedic.
Okay.
Mental health worker. Now, it's a myth that those people can't actually as well do some of the physical side of the job, like sort out pub fights, carry a taser, carry a gun, if that's what they lead them to in terms of career path. You know, we're not recruiting social workers. What we're recruiting here is people who know what they're going into.
Yeah. The metaphor for me feels a bit
they
like...
They really, really do enjoy it.
The metaphor for me... Do they? Okay, yeah, okay, yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's good. The metaphor for me feels a bit like the army when I was growing up was go out and fight conflict. Yeah. And the army, increasingly, is peacekeeping.
That's right, yeah.
And so, you know, like for all the combat regime that you
putting civil order into countries. Yeah.
Trying to be polite to people in Helmand province.
Very similar. Very similar. I think you're spot on. It's like, and you know, the changing nature of an organisation's business, if it was a business, and you know, again, we were discussing this last night, there would be a different market. You know, our market's changed. We've still got a lot of bad people to lock up, and we've still got some stuff to do that is, quite honestly, we do a lot of enforcement work because that needs to be done. But a big proportion of our work now is working with other organisations to try to intervene early to stop people escalating into crisis.
And you and I talked, so I don't know if I can get this in, but you and I discussed something that I was really interested in, and I see a link in what you've just been saying there. About, I said that the one of the things that works really well at companies in offices is bring your dog to work day, and because it forces interactions between people who normally wouldn't interact. Someone sees a delightful cocker spaniel, runs over to pet it, says, "Oh, what do you do?" And you gave me an example of how that sort of thing's relevant to policing.
Well, I was recently over in the States talking to a range of law enforcement leads around this topic, and the FBI use dogs to put into situations where people have been exposed to trauma staff. And they have got dogs that are trained to do that. Very much like you would get dogs who are trained to go into dementia homes. You know, they're very, you know, that, like you say, it's it breaks down barriers. It gets a conversation going and it's slightly different. And I think with this agenda, you've got to innovate. You've got to sometimes do things that just appear so counterculture. You know, bringing mindfulness in to the workplace is becoming more and more popular as a route where people can, you know, be present, calm down, get focused, get some reflection time. You know, in my force, we've got numerous contemplation rooms. Now, on Twitter, funnily enough, we have had a bit of a bashing over this off some probably more traditional people in policing who've gone, we used to go to a pub in my day. We'll have a game of snooker, you know. Right, well, not people don't go to the pub anymore.
Mm.
You know, we don't have snookers. We don't have bars in police stations. And actually, that might have worked for your generation. It isn't working for this generation. So let's just give people choices. And, the you know, if you're sat all day viewing indecent images, grading them to get prosecutions, you need somewhere in your workspace you can go to chill out. Probably mainly before you go home, especially if you've got a family, because you need to recalibrate and get your head straight. And that is a duty of care from people who are doing that to keep the public safe. That's the least we can do.
Mm.
I mean, you're talking about £1,000 spent at IKEA to get one of these rooms kitted out. And it's come from the staff, this, not me.
Mm.
They've done it. It's like viral. It's like something that they've crowd funded themselves, have crowdsourced it.
Yeah.
If I'd have done these contemplation rooms, I'm not going in them because he's, you know, it's the bosses. You know, you get into some really interesting aspects, I think, when you start through the wellbeing agenda about things like the power of the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that hierarchical organisations don't really work around this topic.
Blimey, I mean, how do you deal with that in the police? I'd have thought police is like, by default, a very hierarchical organisation.
Well, it is, and of course, that's one of its strengths, because it's an emergency, hierarchies work.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want everybody stood like going, why am I standing here? Right, well, just stand there until we've cleared this scene. You need a hierarchy, and that's one of the strengths of the police, but actually, in terms of things like staff engagement, well-being, employee voice, it's a real problem.
Yeah.
Because to get through it all, most organisations have got a hierarchy. If you're flattening hierarchy too much, there's only certain types of organisations that can cope with that.
Mm.
So what we've tried to do is have multiple channels of engagement with our staff so that we can really give them a voice. It also saves you a lot of money. You know, there's a lot of people spending money on wellbeing interventions that are completely pointless and the staff aren't interested in them. And I don't want to engage with them. But somebody somewhere thought it was a good idea. You'll find that most things that you need for well-being are actually free because it's how I treat you.
Okay.
It's about how we treat each other. There are things, resourcing, logistics, you know, IT, training, shift patterns. It's everything to do with an organisation. But actually, what really does damage people's well-being is if they are not treated with respect.
Right.
And fairly.
So they might be treated with disrespect when they're out on responding to a call, but if they're treated with respect when they're back in like the workplace.
Yeah, fairly and honestly, you know, not hands off people. It's like.
What happens when someone knows they've messed up?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, you know, when
it's high stakes stuff sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is with it, one of the problems is that. We expect our people on the front line, particularly and in call centres and stuff, to make really tough decisions because you've got to make a choice about what you do and what you don't do because everything can't be done. And sometimes when we've got the worst of two options to choose, it's a lose-lose decision. We stand accused of then blaming the individual rather than the organisation taking responsibility for it. You know, so I think what you need, you know, what what you want is to encourage people to be able to take risks and make risky decisions, because that fundamentally is the business that we're in. And I think we do that. The weird thing is with it in policing, you know, we take some of the highest risks that you would ever take in terms of decision making around things like firearms and what have you. When it comes to, there's a guy's come up to me on the street. This is something that we know happens. Somebody's come up to me on the street. I'm working, you know, the sort of where all the bars are, and someone's punched him in the nose, and he's got a bloody nose. And he goes, "Somebody just punched me." We call an ambulance. When you ring the ambulance up, they say, "Why are you ringing us for this? Just, is he walking? Is he okay? Is he with his mate?" "Well, get a taxi and go to A&E." And you've got the police that go, "Oh, well, you know, if he walks away and falls over and dies, I'm in trouble."
Right.
Because I've spoken to him now. So there's this real sort of legitimate concern that people are going to be dealt with disproportionately.
Right.
That doesn't exist in a lot of other professions.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we've got to correct that, and we've got to do that by instilling in our people that, you know, if it's a genuine and honest mistake and they've done the best they could at the time, we've got to support them 100%. Yeah. If they're bad, then we need to get them out. But the vast majority come to work every day trying to do a decent job.
And talk me through this. So you've created this blue light wellbeing framework.
Yeah.
So is this trying to sort of institutionalise some of what you've discussed?
Yeah, what we needed was, because people do tend to either run away from this because it looks like a big elephant to start having a go at, or throw the kitchen sink at it, as I've said before. So we wanted to get the evidence base for it, and we worked with Dame Carol Black, Public Health England, who actually funded Oscar Kilo. And that was done as an Oscar Kilo because it's phonetic alphabet. You know, the brand of it is very much a blue light brand. And, you know, what inside that is a set of questions, self-assessments that say, right, if you're getting all this stuff done brilliantly, which nobody ever will be, because it's actually all about, there's a lot of stuff about changing culture and that leadership, all that sort of stuff, then this is what you need to be doing to deliver world-class wellbeing in blue light services. We are the only, as far as I'm aware, country service that have got a sector-specific evidence base that people can follow like that. Every force in this country is signed up to doing that. The fire service nationally is signed up to it. We've got the non-home office forces, so Northern Ireland, Scotland, British Transport Police, National Crime Agency. Everybody basically goes into the Oscar Kilo site, does the self-assessment. We have a researcher employed who mines your self-assessment, finds with the gap analysis, and then we're doing workshops and, you know, peer-to-peer stuff to just get better and better at it. So, and over time, if new research comes in, we'll feed it into that. We can adapt the framework moving forward. So, you know, I always say to people, don't just do something, stand there. You know, don't say, as a senior leader of an organisation, "I'm interested in your wellbeing, Bruce," unless before you've done that, you've worked out exactly what you're going to do about it.
Hang on, don't just say something, stand there.
Don't just run off, because we're a can-do organisation. Okay. It's not one of our strengths, is this, okay. You know. We're off. And that's one of our big strengths, but it also drives us nuts sometimes, because we sometimes, when it comes to things like this, you've just got to stop. And the main thing you've got to do when you stop is two things. Look at the evidence that's out there, and listen to your people who are nearest the work. Because how I see work isn't how it used to be when I was out there.
Yeah.
And so I need to instill in my leaders that they need to go and observe people in the work and then listen to what they're telling you about how it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really...
Would you ever do a back to the floor day? Would you ever?
I was out. I did Pride in Blackpool.
Okay.
On Saturday, which was a community event.
Yeah.
Most of us did it on our days off.
Okay.
You know, and another thing that, from some sort of like anonymous accounts, we've had a bit of a criticism for.
Right.
Why are you going to a Pride event when we're all busy? Well, it's nothing to do with you being busy.
Yeah.
Anyway, when I'd done that, I was in full uniform. I went for a drive around Blackpool, shouted up for a couple of jobs. You know, I know Blackpool because I used to work there, so I'd be confident doing it. My preferred way is not to go out necessarily and accompany a response officer, for example. My preferred way is to walk into the operational environment and just sit down and have a chat with people.
Right.
And say what's going on for you.
Hear what they're saying.
And then, you know, turn the leadership deal into, well, my job as a leader is to work on the basis you're trying to do the best you can. And my job is to unblock things that are getting in your way. So in your workplace, there'll be things that drive you nuts. These are niggles that really bug you. And I've spoken to people, for example, like family liaison officers for traffic collisions. These are people who do a high emotional labour job. Yeah. And they say to me, I'm up for it. I do this job. I actually really love doing this job because I do my best for families. Drives me nuts is when I get back to Nick and the printer's not working.
Right.
That's my job to fix.
Right.
Are you with me?
So not simple,
all,
but
it's
like...
not all difficult stuff, this.
Right.
Right. If I went through with you what your niggles were with your workplace, most of them are fixable.
Yeah.
There'll be daft bureaucracy, forms that shouldn't need filling in.
Names of people who sit near me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. It's like people making things harder work than they need to be. You know what I mean? It's like, why does it take so long to get something done? So I think what the wellbeing agenda does is it focuses on the people nearest the work, and it makes the support functions that are meant to be there, enabling them to do that job, really get their act together.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
As I say, two episodes this week. Look out for the second one on Thursday. I've linked to a couple of the initiatives that Andy discussed in the show notes. So look at your podcast app and you should see them down the page. The best way to stay connected to the show is to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify or Stitcher. You can subscribe there. I hope you've enjoyed that. It's a real pleasure and a real honour to chat to Andy. Before I go, I should remind you that my own book, The Joy of Work, is now available for pre-order on Audible. So you can go along if you enjoy these podcasts. You can hear me reading the book for you. The book's out on Blue Monday in January. Go along and you can pre-order that on Audible. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.